Actually, I am going to talk a little bit about the Jewish Agency now. Article 4 of the Mandate for Palestine calls for, quote, the recognition of an appropriate Jewish agency as a public body for the purpose of advising and cooperating with the administration of Palestine in such economic, social, and other matters as may affect the establishment of the Jewish national home and the interests of the Jewish population of Palestine. What that means is that the Jews are going to have free rein to run their social lives. Everything other than defense. Ostensibly, it's what the British would call home rule. Right? They're going to have the ability, according to that, to set up institutions for the sick, histadrut, maybe some labor organizations, maybe some stores like Hamashbir we talked about, a school system, which we've talked about way a little earlier. All those types of things are going to be set up, permitted, because it's going to make it easier for the British to rule the country if they don't have to worry about that. And they're going to do it in coordination with the British. They're going to have liaisons, and they're going to talk about it. But the truth of the matter is, at this point, there's nothing that the Zionists are going to do, that the Zionists will do, that will upset the British. The Zionists are ecstatic that the British have come into the country. They just dealt with the Ottoman Turks for 25, 30 years. Right? They couldn't get anything done. And they did have an office in Constantinople. And they still couldn't do anything. In fact, during World War I, Arthur Rubin had to go to Constantinople. His office was moved there. Did you know that?
Yes? Had access to it.
All right. So I'd already talked about it. Started with Rubin in 1908, the concept of a self-ruling Jewish organization or office there. By 1929, we're going to get the Jewish Agency that we know of today. And the Jewish Agency remains a major, major player. There were many calls, by the way, to dismantle the Jewish Agency after the State of Israel was born. But it didn't happen, and for good reason, as we're going to see. It's seen as a place where the diaspora and the people in Israel can meet and work on things together. And that's part of the ethos of the state. It's not just a state for its own sake. It's a state for the Jewish people. So this is where this comes from. After much behind-the-scenes work in 1929, Chaim Weizmann finally brings non-Zionists into the Jewish Agency. Now, Weizmann really wanted non-Zionists for two reasons. One, they had a lot of money, particularly the ones in America. And two, because of that, they had access to their governments. And he knows, as a guy who deals with governments all the time, that the more friends in high places, the absolute better. The principle involved for the non-Zionists was not Zionism per se, although they were warming up to it. You know, we've talked about how in Great Britain there was a time when a lot of Jews were non-Zionists. Well, that was the same case in America. Keep in mind the Reform rabbis in this country in general were across the board against Zionism, with the exception of people like Stephen Wise, who was going to be involved here, and then in a little bit Abba Hillel Silver, who's going to become really one of the Jabotinsky of American Zionist movement. In some regards, the principle is helping Jews. Just like we're sending aid to poor Jews in Poland and Romania, and Ort is doing stuff in India and what have you, we're going to help the Jews here because they need help. And after all, it's still the land of Israel. There's something noble about that. But we're not going to get involved in Zionist politics. We're not going to get involved in the Zionist Congress, for example, and what have you. The expanded board had really a best and the brightest list of people. Shalom Ash, who was a famous Yiddish writer, Chaim Nachman Bialik, the great Hebrew poet and writer, Albert Einstein, whom we know of, Leon Blum, anyone know who Leon Blum was?
Prime Minister of France.
He was about to become Prime Minister of France in a couple years. And Herbert Samuel is brought back into this. Herbert Samuel is still fulfilling government roles. Felix Warburg, an American Jew and a prominent non-Zionist, at the end of the meeting where they make the final negotiations, we're going to enter into this bond with you in the expanded Jewish Agency, he puts his arm around Chaim Weizmann and says, Chaim, you don't have to worry about going up and down the East Coast in the United States anymore, begging for money, schnorring here, schnorring there. We're going to take care of all that. Well, a couple days later, Lewis Marshall drops dead. Lewis Marshall was one of the more prominent, if not the most prominent, American Jewish leader who was going to give a lot of money. And then a little while after that, the stock market crashed. Chaim Weizmann had all types of problems all over again. And now he had an expanded board of people who were, to say the least, heavily distracted from what they were doing. And, of course, we know the Wall Street crash had implications all over the place. Meanwhile, also by 1929, the British realized that things had been radicalizing for the Jews and Arabs in terms of the way they're viewing each other and in terms of the way their communities have great friction. And keep in mind, Jews and Arabs are living next to each other in Jerusalem and Haifa in particular. And there's still a community in Hebron, even though it's a largely ultra-Orthodox community. A lot of this, again, goes back to the Mufti of Jerusalem and the statements, the preachings, and if you've ever read any of the sermons, a lot of them survive. They're bone-chilling. For about a year leading up to 29, there have been demonstrations and counter-demonstrations at the Western Wall. The Western Wall then is not what we think of now. It had a plaza that was not as wide as this room, and it wasn't even as long. There were houses along what we now call the Western Wall Plaza, just like the rest of the old city might have it, particularly when you go into the Arab quarters, the Muslim and the Christian quarter today. Well, Jews go, and they start some demonstrations. And then August comes, and we're getting ready for the high holidays. And the Jews put up a screen to separate men from women. All right, this is standard Orthodox practice. And these aren't the Zionists that are doing this, by the way. The Mufti and his followers feel that this is the beginning of a synagogue, and it is violating the status quo. The status quo with the British is, we're not going to change anything here. So there are some riots that begin to take place. Escalates into violence. There are counter-demonstrations by Jabotinsky, the revisionist, and some of his followers. Rioting soon erupts in Jerusalem, Haifa, and even Tel Aviv. The Arabs even get into Tel Aviv from Jaffa, see some rioting. Some kibbutzim and moshavs are attacked. Guess how many soldiers the British have in Palestine at this point? 100. They have 100 soldiers in Palestine. It's nothing. They have to call a garrison in from Amman, Jordan, which takes a day or so to get there. There's 3 days of rioting. There are particularly bloody, bloody tales of what happened in Hebron, in Hebron. You can read about them, and certainly in this book, One Palestine Complete. By the end of the week, 133 Jews are dead. 399 are injured. 110 Arabs are dead, and 232 are injured, mostly from British troops firing back at them to stop the rioting. This is not a good thing for future Arab-British relations by any stretch of the imagination. It's obviously disastrous for any sense of Jewish-Arab rapprochement. It's particularly brutal in Hebron, as I mentioned, where 68 Jews are killed. Half the community is slaughtered, and I really mean slaughtered. Half the community, people forget, is saved by Arabs who welcome their neighbors of many generations into their homes and hide them from the mob. So that's the other part of the story that deserves some focus, too. Here's one of the synagogues to show you how complete the destruction was. Apologies. That's the remnants of the Hebron Yeshiva after the 29 riots. And I don't know what happened to the building after that. Here's Jewish families who lived in the old city. They're fleeing. And, you know, I was trying to figure out, looking at this picture, if they were running. And I think they are, if you look at this guy right here, the way his foot's way up like that and the way this guy's foot is up like that. That's, you know, one can only imagine. I mean, I assume this is the Jaffa Gate, or right by there, one of the gates, obviously. And to think that that was happening then, not so long ago. Not so long ago. In our lifetime, obviously, we knew people. We were, you know, we're living people were living who experienced that. So what do you think the British did after there was rioting and murder and mayhem?
Stopped immigration.
Put together a commission. Can't do that until you put together a commission. Right? Yeah, the Jews have nothing on them in this regard. Committees. This is something called the Shaw Commission, S-H-A-W. And the Shaw Commission was going to set the pattern for the ones that are going to come. Certainly the Peel Commission we're going to get to in 37. They published their report in March 1930. They dispatched a delegation to Israel, to Palestine. They heard from 120 witnesses in public, 20 behind closed doors. Most of the evidence came from the mandatory officials, the British officials from the mandate, which didn't really make sense. They should have talked to the people more so who were involved in it, but they were doing their official duty. They expanded on their scope and mission. Their scope and mission was to find out what happened in the riots. Who caused it? Why did it happen? What happened? That was it. They decided to go a little farther and make policy recommendations as well. It's never good for the Jews in this period when a British commission of inquiry makes policy recommendations, because there's always an effort to minimize Jewish concerns, to pacify the Arab needs. Because of the overwhelming numbers and increasingly the war question and the sympathies that some have. And keep in mind, some of the sympathy also comes from people like T.E. Lawrence and other soldiers who fought with Arabs in the Great Revolt during World War I against the Turks. They said candidly, it all started by Arabs attacking Jews. There was no question of that. They talked about the Western Wall dispute. They talked about inflammatory publications on both sides. Remember, this is an era not only of the newspaper, but of the flyer that's posted on walls. If you go to Mea Shearim today, you can see walls plastered with flyers. They talked about the expansion of the Jewish agency, making the Arabs feel threatened that the Jews were increasing their rule. They talked about the inadequate forces to maintain order. They talked about conflicting wartime pledges. This is the first time that the British admit we may have made a mistake here. We told the Zionists that they were going to have a Jewish national home, even though we've already limited that in some regards. But we also told the Arabs and Faisal, when they revolted on our behalf against the Ottoman Turks, that they would be able to have independent rule, even though we didn't quite tell them that Palestine was going to be included in that area. The bottom line is that this called for protecting the rights of the Arabs. The Arabs were being limited because they were no longer getting the good land. They were being forced into the cities. Their lifestyle was being threatened. Forget the concept of modernity, right? This actually happens in modernity, or modernization of a traditional society. The Zionists saw this as a real blow. Let me see if I have the quote on here. Of the Shaw Commission. Here we go. It's a little long, but I'm going to read it anyway because it really sets the pattern for what's to come. The disturbances took the form, in the most part, of a vicious attack by Arabs on Jews, accompanied by wanton destruction of Jewish property. Okay, that's true. A general massacre of the Jewish community at Hebron was narrowly averted. In a few instances, Jews attacked Arabs and destroyed Arab property. These attacks, though inexcusable, were in most cases in retaliation for wrongs already committed by Arabs in the neighborhood in which the Jewish attacks occurred. No arguments from the Zionists at this point. After the disturbance had broken out, the Mufti cooperated with the government in their efforts both to restore peace and to prevent the extension of disorder. Let's make the Mufti happy, because it could be a lot worse. He can be a lot worse. There is incontestable evidence that in the matter of immigration there has been a serious departure by the Jewish authorities from the doctrine accepted by the Zionist organization in 1922 that immigration should be regulated by the economic capacity of Palestine to absorb new arrivals. Now, the Zionists did not exceed their quota. No one was allowed in without the permission of the British. But they wanted to blame the Zionists on this. It would be easier. You had to apply to be able to move to Israel, and you had to show a certain amount of money, or you had to show that you were going to be taken in by a movement, or someone would help you out, or you wouldn't need any of that if you were coming with, you know, a sum over a certain amount. And there was a minimum, and then up from there, graded up. Between 21 and 29, there were large sales of land in consequence of which numbers of Arabs were evicted without the provision of other land for their occupation. So remember, we talked about the nutshell of the land problem is that the Jews buy land from absentee landowners, and they come in and they kick off Arab peasants who have been farming that land for generations, and the Arab farmers think it's the Jews' fault. It's not the absentee landowners. But now what they're saying here is if you're going to kick the Arabs off the land, you have to give them other land, which is not quite the way the free market works. The position is now acute. There is no alternative land to which persons evicted can remove. In consequence, a landless and discontented class is being created. The fundamental cause of the violence, without which, in our opinion, disturbances either would not have occurred or would not have been little more than a local riot, is the Arab feeling of animosity and hostility towards the Jews, consequent upon the disappointment of their political and national aspirations and fear for their economic future. In large regard, what the British are saying is if that's not taken care of, the violence is going to happen again. They weren't necessarily wrong, by the way, and again, I think they were in a position that they couldn't win. It just was absolutely impossible. They really had one of two choices, which would to make the situation work. Stop the immigration or allow it to go unfettered and make the country more Jewish. And they weren't going to do either one of those things. It wasn't, in their view, the right thing to do because they were caught between conflicting promises. The Shaw Commission also called for, not surprisingly, a clarification of British policy. Remember, we already had this in 1922. Now in 1930, they're going to clarify yet again. That led, in October 1930, to what's known as the Passfield White Paper, P-A-S-S-F-I-E-L-D. This is not uncommon in democracies. We all hear this, you know, the president gets up and he acknowledges a problem and says, I've appointed a blue ribbon panel or commission to put together a report, and the report comes out with recommendations, and then another group gets together to implement the recommendations. That's what's taking place here. So this is what the Passfield White Paper did. It recommended limiting Jewish immigration due to the lack of land to support it. Now, you know, again, we can do this in a course like this. This is not a four-credit course at Towson University. That was crazy. Actually, I could say that even in a four-credit course because academic freedom and all that. When you look at some of the land that the Jews took... excuse me for a second. Okay, thank you. When you look at some of the land that the Jews took, as you know from your history, they were marshes, they were rocky fields. These weren't plots of land that were ripe for being fertilized. A lot of work had to go into that. So it didn't really matter if the land didn't have quality land. You could turn it into quality land, and look what's happened in Israel since then. And Tel Aviv is the best example, and it's already thriving by then. It was sand dunes, right? It was absolutely sand dunes. They criticized the Jewish Agency and the Histadrut for only promoting Jewish employment. But remember, the League of Nations mandate said that the Jewish Agency or Jewish agencies will be able to support economic and social and other needs for the Jewish community in Palestine in cooperation with the mandate power. They said the National Jewish Home enjoys continued support, but is not central to the mandate governance. That was a real blow. That was a real blow. That was an absolute denying of the Balfour Declaration. Absolutely. And they said the British must honor their obligation to advance both the Arab and Jewish communities, which meant we're not doing enough to advance the Arab communities. But the Arab community is the one that continually says we're not going to participate in any of your organizations. So it's an extremely difficult problem. The Zionist, of course, says this is backtracking from the Balfour Declaration. Chaim Weizmann resigns from the Jewish Agency. He says, British government, you love me so much, you won't have me to kick around anymore. Weizmann's not going to come back until 1934. He's going to stay behind the scenes, but he's not the number one guy. And he's been the number one guy since 1920. Although he was really pulling the strings for the Zionist movement in World War I in Britain, when he moved the axis, went really from Germany over to London in terms of Zionist politics. All right, let's see. I'm going to mention one more figure, and then we're going to take a break. A very notorious figure comes on the scene briefly here. I'm going to say his whole name out. Sheikh Izz ad-Din al-Qassam.
Qassam.
That's right, Qassam Rockets. Exactly right. Not only that, but his name, take the Sheikh off it, is the name of Hamas's military wing today. So this is where that comes from. He comes in from Syria. He organizes a group called the Black Hand. And that's as evil as you think it would be. It's an anti-Zionist and anti-British group. He's obviously an Arab nationalist. He creates military training for the peasants. And the peasants are the easiest to whip up. They have they have the most to lose, right? And they're undereducated.
Least to lose.
Hmm? What?
Least to lose.
Well, no, their lifestyle is being evaporated because the Jews are buying up the land and they're getting kicked off the land.
From that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a lot of the people in the cities wanted to cooperate with the British. Remember, there was this struggle in the Arab ruling class between the Nashashibis and the Husseinis and the Nusaybas, the three main clans of Palestinian class. Unfortunately, the moderates lost. By 1935, he had trained hundreds of men. He had created cells equipped with bombs and guns. These were nasty people. They specialized in going around and trying to attack the various settlements, or the Jewish settlements. They went about their job just trying to kill Jews, hijacking buses, taking them off buses, killing them. There were separate Jewish bus lines. In 1935, two of his men had a firefight with the Palestinian police, and a policeman was killed. The British were very, very angered. This is the first time one of their policemen is killed in Palestine. They launch an all-out manhunt for the Sheikh. They surround him in a cave in the, I think it's in the Galilee, and they kill him in a shootout. He becomes the inspiration for many in the Palestinian nationalist movement. And as we see today, the Hamas military wing is named after him. So this is where all that comes from. And as we break, I want to kind of recap and say what we're seeing now is the British are beginning to, or are cementing their rule on Palestine. It's coming with a cost. They're starting to see how difficult it's going to be. The Jews are in an uproar, right? Things at the end of the decade are far from as good as they were at the beginning of the decade when Alamy comes into Jerusalem and he's treated as the savior, right? And he comes into Tel Aviv and the British say, you know, Europe, there's a great sense of affinity and kinship there. It's getting really rough, and it's only going to get rougher, but the Jews have no choice but to stick it out. Right? And that's another reason, by the way, why the British can side with the Arabs whenever they want. The Jews have no choice, particularly as we get closer to World War II. What are the Jews going to do? The Arabs are the ones who can go to the Germans and say, we'll foment unrest and civil war behind enemy lines for you. So the British want to keep them happy. That's a serious threat to them. All right, on that unhappy note, let's take a break. Might surprise you, but we have a lot to cover. So, all right, so I ended on a bad note, unfortunately, with a negative character, but I want to tell you that there was some good news in this period as well, because there's never a story coming from the land of Israel that's all good or all bad. All right? There's always something of the other in the story, the more you dig. It's like the archaeological hill, the tell. You scrape and there's another layer. Immigration reached its highest level in this period. All right? We talked something called the Fifth Aliyah. Now we're on five Aliyahs. goes from 1929 to 1939. Obviously, it stops in 39 with the beginning of World War II. This is known as the German Aliyah. However, only 50,000 of the 250,000 or so who came were German. But they gave it a great character. It's called the German Aliyah because obviously people fled from Germany. 1932, immigration was 12,500. What's that?
That's when my parents came.
No, what year?
31.
Well, that was earlier. They were in the Fifth Aliyah, but they weren't in the German Aliyah, which came from 33 on, because of Hitler's rise. That's what generally they refer to.
Where did they come?
From Berlin.
So in 32, immigration was 12,500. By 35, it peaked at 66,000. Now, if you remember, in 1918, at the end of World War I, there were 56,000 Jews in the country. So this is 66,000 right there in that 1 year. Metro Tel Aviv has about 46,000 people in 1931. In 1935, it has 135,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, the Germans and others were coming from cities now, not from small towns, and they gravitated toward the most European-looking place they could find. And that was going to be Tel Aviv, and they gravitated toward the places where there were jobs. And those were in the places where the Jews were in control. A number went to Jerusalem, particularly if they were traditional-oriented. A number went to Haifa. You know, there could have been the import-export business was starting to boom then. Between 1932 and 1935, the Jewish population doubled in the land of Israel. It went from 185,000 to 375,000. If you're a Palestinian Arab, you bet you're getting concerned. Right? That's the underside of the story. We said there's always an underside. Or an oversight, depending on which perspective you're looking at. By 1936, one-third of the population of Palestine was Jewish. One in three. We went from one point where we had 56,000 out of 450,000 to one in three. That's an undeniable minority that you can't just shirk off.
Well, now, when you're saying one in three in Palestine, what are you defining as Palestine?
What we would call the land that Israel controls today. And that because that was the land of the mandate, including the Gaza Strip. Although Jews weren't settling in Gaza at that point, which was a pretty small town. The obvious concern was the rise of Hitler. The United States since 1924 basically wasn't letting people in, particularly Jews, from Central and Eastern Europe. In terms of the great waves of immigration. It's a myth, by the way, and I always find it important to point this out, that most Jews in Germany, or many Jews in Germany, stayed put. There were about 550,000 Jews in Germany as of 1933. A full 50% of them left the country by 1939. They went to Poland. They went to France. They went to Belgium. They went to the Netherlands. And a small percentage went to Palestine. They weren't Zionist in the sense that they felt the need to go to Palestine, which, by the way, was a heck of a lot easier to live in than it had been, but it still wasn't Europe. And who can really think that Hitler's going to do what he does, what he's going to do, particularly outside of Germany? So always keep that. If you learn nothing else from this class, even though, you know, it doesn't, in some regards, have anything to do with Zionism, never say that the German Jews stayed there and, you know, like sheep waiting to be slaughtered. 50% of them left. By 39. From 33 to 39. Had the British allowed more immigration, they started clamping down in 36 when the Arab revolt started. Had the British allowed more immigration, more German Jews would be alive today. And we're going to find out in a moment, had certain things worked out certain ways, a significant amount of Jews would be alive today. This was also a time of
Austrian Jews.
Austrian Jews, yeah. Yeah. There's undeniable growth in the Jewish business sector. In 1935, a stock exchange opens on Tel Aviv, which is still in operation today. Exports of produce in 1931 are 2.5 million cases. By 1935, they sorted 5.9 million cases. That's because Jews are farming that unredeemable land that the British think can't be redeemed. This was, a lot of the business, of course, was aided by the arrival of the German Jews, who were middle class and upper middle class, and who were bringing money into Palestine. Remember, these are middle class families often, not just young adults, as we've seen in the past, who ostensibly come with nothing, and are very idealistic and are willing to work and share their labor and what have you.
My father established the metal industry in Israel in 1933.
And do you know how long it took for him to, he came in 31? So it took them a couple years. That's about right. 2 years is about how long it took these folks to get on their feet. And that's phenomenal. When you think about the Jews that came to this country, what we hear is that the first generation were tailors and worked in sweatshops, and it was their kids who really made it. Right? But in Palestine, they got on their feet within a couple years. And they were aided, of course, by the Jewish community at that point. Same case today. You make Aliyah to Israel. I don't know how long you live in a Merkaz Klita.
Well, not anymore. They go for direct absorption.
They go for direct absorption, but you're aided financially by the government. Essentially, you have all types of rights. I mean, this doesn't happen anywhere else. It's pretty remarkable. So one of the things that people were doing in this era is they were building something called stockade and tower settlements. They were, and I actually stayed on one of them. I'll tell you about it in a minute. The British stopped giving permits for new Jewish settlements in 1936, when we're getting ahead of ourselves, but when the Arab revolt started. But there was a Turkish law that the British, for some reason, still observed. You know, law in Palestine and then in Israel is always a combination of British law, Turkish law, common law, and now Israeli law.
It's all from them.
It's all from them, but there's modern precedents that have been taking place in Israeli law, the court rules and all that. It's a mishmash.
Right.
Very hard to be a lawyer. The Turkish law said that if there is a permanent roof on a building, it can't be torn down. Well, because Jews weren't allowed, or anyone wasn't allowed, to set up a settlement, what they would often do is go out at nightfall or nighttime, and they would set up a tower, which had a roof on it, or a building, with a roof on it, and that would be called a settlement. And the Turks the British couldn't take it down, and believe it or not, that's how no less than 52 settlements went up from 36 to 39.
But that's how they have gone up on the West Bank.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then the government says that it doesn't agree to it, but it hooks up water and electricity. But it's a reality. All right, let's take a look at one of those. This is kind of a fun, kitschy film. Let me turn the light off. It's at a kibbutz that is called Kibbutz Chanita, and I lived there from in really late 1985 to 86 for 6 months. So I was really thrilled to find this. Bear with me for a second. So this goes about 9 minutes. That's just who directed it and all that. It's a famous song, "To the Land We'll Go." So this is literally filming, they're setting up one of these settlements. About 40 people would live in these settlements to start. Jewish JNF. I love the kitschiness of these films.
Okay.
And this is the view from Hanita. It's on the Lebanese border. The closest town is called Alma, and it's in Lebanon. These are Haganah troops.
When is this film taking place?
This is taking place in 1937, I believe. It's either 37 or 39. And you can go to Hanita today, and they have a little museum for these stockade and tower settlements. And the original tower is still there. And that's on top of the mountain there. Forget what goes into setting up one of these settlements. It's the first time Israelis ever walked in a line.
Maybe the last time.
Yeah. Right by here, just over the Lebanese border, is where Moshe Dayan lost his eye fighting the Vichy French in World War II.
And also where the three soldiers were kidnapped.
Right. Some of these guys are wearing ties. You notice.
Oh, they're
beast of burden. One of the things to think about too is this has to be a well planned out operation. It's not something they just did. Yeah, there's a number of women.
Oh, there's another one. Some of these people didn't speak any Hebrew. They were ignorant right from the boat.
By the way, this was all
really
done.
I love the tall hats.
What?
Love the tall hats.
This was all done on land that was bought by JNF. It's not as if they were going in and expropriating lands. But the British wouldn't allow them to set up settlements on land they owned. This was the most interesting part to me, that they wanted some type of Jewish presence This is not just the pure socialist that we hear of. It's just a kefir. These settlements were always built with an eyesight of another settlement so that the Jews would have contiguity of their property, so the fields would abut, because they were thinking about the future map that would be drawn. So I think they're signaling to the other kibbutz.
That's
yeah.
See that, or the British are coming. The British are coming.
So look how much they put up in a day. You guys would enjoy that.
Thank you, Steven Spielberg, for rescuing all of these.
Yeah, a lot of these come from the films that I get come from the Steven Spielberg Jewish Film Archives at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Hang on a second. That's a lot of propaganda.
Right.
Sure.
Every walk of life, you know.
Sure.
The religious, the suit and tie.
Yeah.
Right. Even you can do it.
That's right.
Where do you think the film was shown?
Synagogue youth group activity on a Sunday.
Where do you think the film was shown?
Where was it shown? That's a great question. I have no idea.
Was it, for instance, sent to America?
It was probably sent to the United States to show at fundraisers and things like that. Synagogues. Yeah, maybe Europe. Well, this was 39, so it didn't go... I'm pretty sure we're 39. All right, I want to make sure we cover two more things tonight. Something called the Transfer Agreement and the Arab Revolt of 36 to 39, because I've mentioned it a few times. Part of the reason for the German immigration was something called Ha'avara, or the Transfer Agreement. Believe it or not, this is a not well-known chapter of Zionist and Jewish history. It came from a result of the Jews in Palestine having direct negotiations with the Nazi government. They're shaking hands and making agreement for something that was in the mutual interest of both of them, which infuriated Jews outside of Israel. So let's dig into that a little bit. So there were 3 months of negotiations for this. First came with a test case. There was a company called Hanotea. Lintoa means to plant. So this was a citrus planting company in Israel. In 1933, It met with officials from Nazi Germany to talk about transferring capital from Germany to Palestine. It's not necessarily something you think that the Nazi government wants to do. However, there's a worldwide boycott of Nazi Germany-made products at this time. Not everybody's observing it, but for example, in the United States, the Jews are. They're getting their allies to do it. It's taking place in England. It's taking place in Poland. Jewish-owned businesses throughout Europe, outside of Germany, other than Russia, the Soviet Union, of course, are not welcoming in any German-made products anymore. This is actually beginning to hurt the German government. So Hanotea comes up with a deal with the German government. Hanotea is going to take money from prospective immigrants, use it to buy German goods, and then the goods and the immigrants are going to go to Palestine and be sold in Palestine. What this is going to do, of course, is help the Germans because they're selling various goods, and it's helping the Zionists because it's getting people to Israel. So the Yishuv takes note of this, and in 1935, they form something called the Transfer Company to deal with this. German bureaucrats like this a lot. Hitler wasn't wild about it at first, because after all, you were helping this Jewish group. However, he was persuaded that it was a good thing to do, that it would break the back of the German boycott. He said, okay, I'm willing to do it. And in fact, Hitler defended it through 1939 to over opposition within his government. A total of about $100 million in wealth came into the Yishuv with this agreement. The Nazis even permitted Jewish vocational training camps in Germany for prospective immigrants. The Zionism, you should know, from 33 to 39, became very, very popular in Germany for obvious reasons. It stoked Jewish nationalism and it stoked a sense of hope, which was quickly evaporating on all other fronts. Their liaison on this? Adolf Eichmann, who ironically, so Adolf Eichmann was negotiating with Jews over this transfer of money to Israel. Eichmann, obviously, eventually in 1961, is going to be captured by Israeli agents. 1963, he's put on trial. He's executed. He's the only person in the history of the State of Israel ever to be executed because it's crimes against humanity. That's the only case in which Israeli law allows someone to be executed, with the exception of military law in certain situations. Hitler got rid of some Jews. He found a market for German goods. And he showed the world he was willing to deal with Jews. Because for Hitler, it was a good deal. American Jews were furious. The revisionists were furious. The boycott was what they wanted. And this broke Jewish solidarity. And we now know, actually, from what historians tell us, the boycott really had the Nazis worried. Because they bought into the myth, of course, the Jews controlled the world economy and what have you. So they were victims of their own ideology. The man behind all this was a guy named Chaim Arlazorov. Now, you know a little bit about him?
I was reading, but he was murdered.
He was murdered. That's why we don't know much about him. Yeah. He was 33 years old, and he was murdered. But he was a brilliant young man. He was an ideological presence in the labor movement. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. He was born in 1899. His life tragically ended in 1933. He was born in the Ukraine. In 1905, not dissimilar to a lot of stories that we've heard in this class, his home was attacked in a pogrom. This helped shape his ideology. His family fled across the border to Germany and stayed there. His family is Zionist, so he studies Hebrew with a tutor. He studied economics at the University of Berlin. He goes on to gain a PhD. As a student, he writes on Zionist affairs. He gets active in Zionist groups. He becomes editor of the Zionist Jewish publication, Die Arbeit, or The Worker. He visits Palestine in 1921. He's there at the moment that the Jaffa riots break out. Interestingly, for him, the response to the Jaffa riots is, we need to come to grips with this Arab problem. We need to negotiate with the Arabs. We need to come to an accommodation with the Arabs, unlike the picture that some others come up with. 1923, he's only 24 years old. He's elected to the Zionist organization as the Zionist Actions Committee. Remember, there was a Greater Actions Committee and a Lesser Actions Committee. The Greater Actions Committee was the inner cabal. He was on the Lesser Actions Committee, which was a group of, at times, it could have been as many as 100. But it was quite substantial for someone his age. And Chaim Weizmann took him under his wing. He was the movement's prodigy. In 1924, he turned down a job at the university in Germany to make Aliyah, to move to Palestine. In 26, he's selected to represent the Yishuv to the League of Nations, just like non-observer status of various organizations today at the UN. In 1930, he was one of the people who helped unite the various labor groups to become the Mapai Party, which is the labor party in Israel today. He was considered a moderate because he, like many of that era, renounced the Marxism that he once believed in. The realities didn't meet the Marxist ideology. In 31, he's named political director of the Jewish Agency. By the way, it's called the Jewish Agency for Palestine, is the formal name. He pressed for better relations with the British, and Ben-Gurion fought him on this. What he said was, if we don't have better relations with the British, the Arabs are going to take advantage of that. So he's a realpolitik guy. So he arranges a luncheon at the King David Hotel with some Arab leaders and Chaim Weizmann. Here's our Lazaroff here. Here's Chaim Weizmann. You have all types of people in here, and you can read the caption yourself. It's another thing I want you to realize is that there were continually attempts to create strong relations with moderate Arab leaders. The hope was they would be able to sway the day. King Abdullah in there, by the way, is the grandfather of King Hussein, the great-grandfather and namesake of today's King Abdullah of Jordan. That first King Abdullah, unfortunately, was assassinated in Jerusalem by a Palestinian Arab in 1951 for his relationship with the State of Israel. He was going to meet later that day with Golda Meir. Yeah, no.
Well, Moshe Shoret,
he became foreign minister.
Was the first prime minister?
Foreign minister.
And Ben Zvi was a president.
Second president. Weizmann was the first president. Yeah, and we spoke a little bit about Yitzhak Ben Zvi last week. And we also talked about how he was probably involved in the assassination of De Haas, the Dutch Jewish poet who turned ultra Orthodox. Then, as I said, came Hitler's rise in Germany, and he began getting involved in the transfer agreement. The revisionist Jews were very upset. They said, Jabotinsky was preaching against it as a deal with the devil, not very surprised. Unfortunately, the story doesn't end there. On June 16, 1933, 2 days after coming back from Germany, he and his wife Sima are walking on the Tel Aviv beach. Two people walk toward them. They think nothing of it. People walk on the beach all the time, as they do today. One of them pulled out a pistol, shot him in the head, and assassinated him. There was absolutely no way that they were going to allow this dialogue with Nazi Germany. These men were unknown. They're unknown until this day. Many people think it was done by the revisionists. There's no proof of that. We do know that this was the single largest funeral in the Mandate period. Between 70,000 to 100,000 people came out to his funeral. A revisionist leader named Abba Achimeir was arrested by the Palestinian police force for planning the assassination. His publication that he edited wrote, "The Jewish people will know how to treat such villains." So that is what we call incitement. By the way, people were arrested right after the Rabin assassination, too, in addition to the guy who pulled the trigger. But they were not convicted of anything. Two other rank-and-file revisionists were arrested. Achimier was acquitted. Each of the other two were convicted. But the Palestine Supreme Court, run by the British, overthrew that conviction because they said there was no corroborating evidence linking these guys to the crime in a meaningful way. So that is, you know, we've already seen now, by the way, two assassinations, probably, of Jews against Jews. This is not necessarily a pretty thing that's going on here. It's not a pretty thing at all. passions run deep, very, very deep. And they're only going to get worse because now, in 1936, the Arab Revolt breaks out. There have almost always, not almost always, there have always been skirmishes here and there of Arabs attacking Jewish settlements, dragging Jews off buses, hurting them. HaShomer and then Haganah is growing in terms of defending the Jewish people. There's a lot of secret training going on. What we're getting is a militarized society. We're gaining a militarized society here, particularly if you're out in one of the farming communities. Almost everybody's involved in Haganah, in taking training from Haganah, if you're in a kibbutz or a moshav. The Arabs, of course, were revolting for what? Two things. What's the theme here? Yeah?
They're against Jewish land purchases and Jewish immigration.
Right, and they want independence, so it's three things. I forgot the land purchases. So it's three things. They're being whipped up by the Mufti and is what's called the Arab High Committee, which is his group of advisors, which is a self-appointed group of advisors. First started as civil protests. It quickly developed into violence. British eventually got this first phase under control. They brought in enough troops from Egypt and from Jordan. They did something else too, which was really interesting. They leaned on these moderate Arabs from other countries to help control the Palestinian Arabs, because these guys still had sway in that traditional based society. This was, by the way, the first time that Arab leaders, this era was the first time that Arab leaders outside of Palestine got involved in the Jewish-Arab question. This internationalized in the Arab world the Palestinian-Jewish-Arab question. Then the violence picked up again after the British had it calmed down, and the British reacted harshly. By the time they were in full force against the violence, there were 50,000 British soldiers. Remember, there were 100 British soldiers in 1929. Now there's 50,000 British soldiers, and they're being aided by 15,000 Jewish Haganah soldiers who were cooperating with the British and vice versa, which is a real breakthrough for the Haganah and is laying the groundwork for what's going to become the Israel Defense Forces. By the end, by this phase, 2,000 Arabs had already been killed in combat. One Arab historian said 10% of the adult male population had either been killed or wounded. So this was a major undertaking. Estimates are about 150 Jews were killed. So what did the British do?
Issue a paper.
Yeah! 1937, the Peel Commission. This, by the way, is part of the ways that the British would respond. They put Arabs in front of their convoys as targets in case anybody was looking to ambush them. So the British didn't play fairly either, to say the least. And they had a lot of experience in other parts of the world as well.
They're called human shields, right?
Human shields, yep. According to the United Nations. All right. The British are going to issue the Peel report, commission report. This is Lord Peel. I put this picture because I think it's a lovely picture, first of all. But second of all, it gives you an understanding of how out of tune the British are in some regards with what's going on in Palestine. This is Lord Peel coming out of the King David Hotel.
Into the Rolls Royce.
Uh-huh. When, you know, we've got Sheikh...
With his top hat.
Huh? Yeah, with his top hat. Really, quite a different...
He's not wearing
khaki shorts. There's Ward Wingate. I'm going to get to him in a minute.
That's a better look.
Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I gotta see if I did a quote here. Oh, I didn't do a quote here. Okay, I didn't get it up on here. I might try and get it up for tomorrow. The Peel Commission published its report in 1937. This is a landmark report. The reason it's a landmark report is that it calls for a partition of the land of Israel. It calls for the first time since 135 CE Jewish rule in the land of Israel. Jews are going to get the coast around Tel Aviv. Let's see if I have that map. I do. Jews are in purple. Arabs are in olive drab. This is an internationalized or British-run quarter. When they say internationalized, it means the British are going to run it. Tel Aviv is just on the Jewish side, as you see. You know, by today's standards, we'd say that's absolutely appalling, but when you have nothing, it's something. This is what Weizmann and Ben-Gurion say to the Zionist organization, which doesn't want to approve this. Absolutely, we need this, because we don't really respect these borders anyway. Let's take what we can get today. The Arabs are going to get a lot more land than us. Now, does it surprise you? The Arabs outright rejected this. Why?
They didn't want their presence at all.
They didn't want it at all. Right. They didn't want them to have any... The Arabs, by the way, had always said that Jews that arrived before the Balfour Declaration could stay. Jews that arrived before the Balfour Declaration could stay. Everyone else leaves. We're talking about, you know, 450,000 Jews at this point. They're not... It's 1939. They're, I mean, 1937. They're certainly not going to Germany. They can't go back to the Soviet Union. You know, there's the options are more than limited. So Ben-Gurion and Weizmann accept it. And listen to what Ben-Gurion has to say. 20 years after the Peel Commission report, this is the saddest quote in all of Zionist history. Had a partition referring to the Peel Commission partition plan been carried out, the history of our people would have been different, and 6 million Jews in Europe would not have been killed. Most of them would be in Israel. So in that little sliver of land, I don't know if it could have held 6 million people, but it doesn't really matter, does it? Something would have worked it out. Israel has certainly done things against all the odds. Had that gone into effect, there would have been unlimited immigration, obviously. That was a hallmark of Zionist policy. Many more people would be alive today. Many more people would be alive today. All right. So after the Peel Commission comes out, the Arab revolt starts up again. And that's when we meet our buddy Ord Wingate. Anyone heard of him? What do you know about him?
He's a British military officer.
Yeah, he was an intelligence officer, actually.
He's got the Wingate.
Wingate Institute is named for him. Wingate Institute for Sports and Physical Fitness, I think is the full name.
Yeah. He was a crazy evangelist. He used to run around.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about.
and train the original, you know, the Haganah.
He was known as one of the founders of guerrilla warfare, modern guerrilla warfare.
In Burma. The Americans thought he was crazy. Everybody thought he was crazy.
Right, and he died, unfortunately, in a plane crash in India. The plane wasn't performing well. It wasn't shot down or anything like that. He came to Palestine in 1936, just originally as a regular officer, and then he was promoted to intelligence officer, and he went to his supervisors, and he said, you know, I'd like to train groups of Jews to help us defeat the Arabs. And he was a hardcore Christian Zionist. He was so openly Zionist that eventually they sent him back to England because of it, because clearly it compromised his intelligence gathering abilities. But initially they said, of course, you know, we'll let you do this. So he formed something called, literally it was called Special Night Squads of the Jews. The Special Night Squads were what it was called. And he taught them how to do guerrilla warfare. It was terrific training. He made his headquarters on a kibbutz, which was around the area where one of the judges from, might have been Judge Barak from Shoftim, from that part of the Tanakh was. He wanted to be in that area. He felt an affinity to him. Listen to what an Israeli writer, Yoram Kuniak, said about him, who wrote a book about Wingate. The operations came more frequently and became more ruthless. The Arabs complained to the British about Wingate's brutality and harsh punitive methods. Even members of the field squads complained that during the raids on Bedouin encampments, Wingate would behave with extreme viciousness and fire mercilessly. Wingate believed in the principle of surprise and punishment, which was designed to confine the gangs to their villages. More than once, he had lined rioters up in a row and shot them in cold blood. Wingate did not try to justify himself. Weapons in war cannot be pure. Nonetheless, Wingate is known as the friend or the friendly commander. He, as much as anyone else, is responsible for the Haganah being an effective fighting force, because he was able to train the elite, and the elite eventually formed into the Palmach, which was the strike force of the Haganah during the war. The Arab revolt would stall out. Good, we're going to end on time. The Arab revolt would stall out in 1939. It didn't just stall out because it was on the eve of war, but the British obviously used very strong methods to control the Arab revolt. But the British from 37 on began exiling Palestinian Arab leaders when they could find them, like the Mufti had fled, and some of his others from the Arab High Council had fled, or High Commission, I'm sorry, had fled. So there was really no coordination in the field. But that, of course, you know, immigration, by the way, had stopped, right? That ostensibly had stopped by now. By the end of the revolt, 5,000 Arabs were dead, and about 400 Jews and 200 Brits. It also stopped because the French finally told the Arab High Command, which was in Syria at that point, that they can no longer operate on their territory. The French had allowed a lot of this to go on, so we can thank the French in some regards for the continuing violence. You're raising your hand?
No.
Okay. The impact of the Arab revolt. Interestingly enough, and it was a bloody, bloody time, but for Jews, their lives were threatened, but the yeshuv was not threatened. Right? The Arab revolt was as much against the British as it was against the Jews. Immigration was not affected by the Arab revolt. It was affected by the British. 52 new settlements were founded in this period. The Jewish and Arab economies were further disengaged, which helped set the stage for a state in 1948. It helped separate the two peoples fully and completely. The Jews, and we talked about this 2 weeks ago with Mayor Dizengoff, appealed to the British to open a port in Tel Aviv because they could no longer use the port in Jaffa. So the Jews got a port in Tel Aviv out of this. The Jews gained invaluable military training. They saw the British up close. They were trained by the British up close. Jewish weapons manufacturing increased. The British looked askance for a brief period at that. The Arabs all quit their jobs in the mandate, working for the mandate, whether it's policemen or mailmen or what have you. The Jews took those jobs. The Jews actually got more jobs because of the Arab revolt. However, a complete Palestinian national identity was formed. Palestinian Arab national identity was formed. There would be no cooperating with the British for the Arabs. And the Palestinians became fiercely independent. They didn't want to be in a confederation with Jordan. They didn't want to be part of greater Arab whatever. They wanted their own country. And we already talked about the internationalization of the issue. I'm going to make one more comment, and then I'm going to let you go. The British made one final push for Arab-Jewish rapprochement, Gesundheit, on the eve of World War II. It was called the St. James Palace Conference because it took place in St. James Palace. It took place in the spring of 1939. And this was, again, I'm going to skip a lot of the details just to tell you that it was crazy in that the Arabs refused to sit with the Jews, so they had to have two opening ceremonies. The Jews didn't really want to go to it because they knew that the British were going to come down on the side of the Arabs at this point for certain, which is eventually what happened. They couldn't come to an agreement on anything. So the British announced that they were going to issue their own new policies within a few months. 2 months later, they issued new policies. It's exactly what they did. And this is where some of you may have heard of the famous White Paper of 1939. The White Paper of 1939 said that for 5 years there will be immigration of 15,000 Jews a year into Palestine for 75,000 total. And then there would be no more immigration unless the majority of citizens in Palestine agreed to more immigration. There would be no more land sold to Jews, and so on and so on. Ben-Gurion famously said, we mentioned this when we talked about Ben-Gurion, we shall fight the white paper as if there were no war, and we will fight the war as if there were no white paper. There were protests all over Palestine in the Jewish community.
What was the specific date that was issued?
May 17th, 1939. let's see. Here's the Jews working with the British, the Jewish Special Night Squads. Here's one of the anti-white paper demonstrations in 39. Every Jew came out against this, other than the ultra-Orthodox. They're a minority in the community at this point. Here's just one response by Ben-Gurion. It is a policy in which the Jewish people will not acquiesce. Such a regime can only be established and maintained by force. It seems only too probable that the Jews will have to fight rather than submit to Arab rule, and repressing the Jewish rebellion against British policy will be as unpleasant a task as the repression of the Arab rebellion has been. What I want you to think about is how supremely confident Ben-Gurion remains. He's just threatened the British Empire. Right? That's not something you do lightly, and that's not something that we would have done in Zionist history until this point, you know, despite everything else that has happened. He is prepared for separation and independence well before most other people. Now, we're going to pick up with the British Mandate once again when we deal with World War II and the aftermath. That'll be actually our last lecture, but the British Mandate actually goes until May 14th, 1948. Any questions?
If I may add about Ben-Gurion,
sure.
He was the one, after the 67 war, to advise the government of Israel to withdraw from all the territories that were taken after the war. And no one was listening to him. We wouldn't be facing what we are facing today in the settlements on the West Bank and other areas.
But to be fair, he also told Yitzhak Rabin before the war, don't strike first, the world is going to be against us.
Yeah.
So, there's always the underside.
This is one, but after the war, if they had returned it, we wouldn't face this endless conflict.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next week, we're talking about Hebrew culture.